Threaten from Happiness is the Greatest Good, by Jeremy Bentham. About the author. Jeremy Bentham's abiding concern in life was the total reform of British society and law based on the principle of utility. He believed this principle was the most reasonable guide to both individual morality and public policy. He formed the Westminster Review and convinced radicals, opposed to both the Whigs and Tories, to join the Benthamite movement. The group founded University College, London. About the work. In his introduction to the principles of morals and legislation, Bentham attributes the inconsistency of English law, its complexity as well as its inhumanness, to its foundation on the moral feelings of sympathy and antipathy. He argues that the laws of all nations should be rationally based, not emotionally based, on what appeared to him to be the self-evident principle of the greatest good for the greatest number. In an effort to apply this principle of utility to legal reform, Bentham develops the hedonistic, or as it is sometimes called, the philosophic calculus. As an ethical teleologist, Bentham devises a method of calculating the most pleasure versus the least pain by means of a quantitative scale. Historically, the hedonistic calculus was a major step in the development of rational decision theory and utility theory. Ideas of interest from morals and legislation. Threading selection from morals and legislation. Of the principle of utility. Chapter 1, Part 1. Nature has placed mankind under the governance of two sovereign masters, pain and pleasure. It is for them alone to point out what we ought to do, as well as to determine what we shall do. On the one hand, the standard of right and wrong, on the other, the chain of causes and effects, are fastened to their throne. They govern us in all we do, in all we say, in all we think. Every effort we can make to throw off our subjection will serve but to demonstrate and confirm it. In words, a man may pretend to abjure their empire, but in reality he will remain subject to it all the while. The principle of utility recognizes this subjection and assumes it for the foundation of that system, the object of which is to rear the fabric of felicity by the hands of reason and of law. Systems which attempt to question it deal in sounds instead of sense, in caprice instead of reason, in darkness instead of light. But enough of metaphor and declamation. It is not by such means that moral science is to be improved. Chapter 1, Part 2. The principle of utility is the foundation of the present work. It will be proper, therefore, at the outset to give an explicit and determinate account of what is meant by it. By the principle of utility is meant that principle which approves or disapproves of every action whatsoever according to the tendency it appears to have to augment or diminish the happiness of the party whose interest is in question, or what is the same thing, in other words, to promote or to oppose that happiness. I say of every action whatsoever, and therefore not only of every action of a private individual, but of every measure of government. Chapter 1, Part 3. By utility is meant that property in any object whereby it tends to produce benefit, advantage, pleasure, good or happiness, all this in the present case comes to the same thing, or what comes again to the same thing, to prevent the happening of mischief, pain, evil, or unhappiness to the party whose interest is considered. If that party be the community in general, then the happiness of the community. If a particular individual, then the happiness of that individual. Chapter 1, Part 4. The interest of the community is one of the most general expressions that can occur in the phraseology of morals. No wonder that the meaning of it is often lost. When it has a meaning, it is this. The community is a fictitious body composed of individual persons who are considered as constituting, as it were, its members. The interest of the community then is, what is it, the sum of the interests of the several members who compose it. Chapter 1, Part 5. It is in vain to talk of the interest of the community without understanding what is the interest of the individual. A thing is said to promote the interest, or to be for the interest, of an individual when it tends to add to the sum total of his pleasures, or what comes to the same thing, to diminish the sum total of his pains. Chapter 1, Part 6. An action then may be said to be conformable to then principle of utility, or for shortness sake, to utility, meaning with respect to the community at large, when the tendency it has to augment the happiness of the community is greater than any it has to diminish it. Chapter 1, Part 7. A measure of government which is but a particular kind of action performed by a particular person or persons may be said to be conformable to or dictated by the principle of utility, when in like manner the tendency which it has to augment the happiness of the community is greater than any which it has to diminish it. Chapter 1, Part 8. Of an action that is conformable to the principle of utility, one may always say either that it is one that ought to be done, or at least that it is not one that ought not to be done. One may say also that it is right it should be done, at least that it is not wrong it should be done, that it is right action, at least that it is not wrong action. When thus interpreted, the words ought and right and wrong, and others of that stamp, have a meaning, when otherwise they have none. Of principles adverse to that of utility. Chapter 1, Part 2. A principle may be different from that of utility in two ways, either by being constantly opposed to it. This is the case with a principle which may be termed the principle of asceticism. By being sometimes opposed to it, and sometimes not, as it may happen. This is the case with another, which may be termed the principle of sympathy and antipathy. Chapter 2, Part 3. By the principle of asceticism I mean that principle which, like the principle of utility, approves or disapproves of any action according to the tendency which it appears to have to augment or diminish the happiness of the party whose interest is in question, but in an inverse manner. Approving of actions in as far as they tend to diminish his happiness, disapproving of them in as far as they tend to augment it. Chapter 2, Part 9. The principle of asceticism seems originally to have been the reverie of certain hasty speculators, who having perceived, or fancied, that certain pleasures, when reaped in certain circumstances, have at the long run been attended with pains more than equivalent to them, took occasion to quarrel with the very thing that offered itself under the name of pleasure. Having then got thus far, and having forgot the point which they set out from, they pushed on, and went so much further as to think it meritorious to fall in love with pain. Even this, we see, is at bottom but the principle of utility misapplied. Chapter 2, Part 10. The principle of utility is capable of being consistently pursued, and it is but tautology to say that the more consistently it is pursued, the better it must ever be for humankind. The principle of asceticism never was, nor ever can be, consistently pursued by any living creature. Let but 1/10 part of the inhabitants of this earth pursue it consistently, and in a day's time they will have turned it into a hell. Chapter 2, Part 11. Among principles adverse to that of utility, that which at this day seems to have most influence in matters of government is what may be called the principle of sympathy and antipathy. By the principle of sympathy and antipathy, I mean that principle which approves or disapproves of certain actions, not on account of their tending to augment the happiness, nor yet on account of their tending to diminish the happiness of the party whose interest is in question, but merely because a man finds himself disposed to approve or disapprove of them. Holding up that approbation or disapprobation is a sufficient reason for itself, and disclaiming the necessity of looking out for any extrinsic ground. Thus far in the general department of morals, and in the particular department of politics, measuring out the quantum as well as determining the ground of punishment by the degree of the disapprobation. Chapter 2, Part 12. It is manifest that this is rather a principle in name than in reality. It is not a positive principle of itself, so much as the term employed to signify the negation of all principle. What one expects to find in a principle is something that points out some external consideration as a means of warranting and guiding the internal sentiments of approbation and disapprobation. This expectation is but ill fulfilled by a proposition which does neither more nor less than hold up each of those sentiments as a ground and standard for itself. Chapter 2, Part 8. In looking over the catalogue of human actions, says a partisan of this principle, in order to determine which of them are to be marked with the seal of disapprobation, you need but to take counsel of your own feelings. Whatever you find in yourself, the propensity to condemn, is wrong for that very reason. For the same reason, it is also meet for punishment. In what proportion it is adverse to utility, or whether it be adverse to utility, at all is a matter that makes no difference. In that same proportion also is it meet for punishment. If you hate much, punish much. If you hate little. Punish as you hate. If you hate not at all, punish not at all. The fine feelings of the soul are not to be overborne and tyrannized by the harsh and rugged dictates of political utility. Chapter 2, Part 24. The various systems that have been formed concerning the standard of right may all be reduced to the principle of sympathy and antipathy. One account may serve to for all of them. They consist all of them in so many contrivances for avoiding the obligation of appealing to any external standard, and for prevailing upon the reader to accept of the author's sentiment or opinion as a reason for itself. Value of a lot of pleasure or pain. Chapter 4, Part 1. Pleasures, then, and the avoidance of pains, are the ends that the legislator has in view. It behooves him therefore to understand their value. Pleasures and pains are the instruments he has to work with. It behooves him therefore to understand their force, which is again, in other words, their value. Chapter 4, Part 2. To a person considered by himself, the value of a pleasure or pain considered by itself will be greater or less, according to the four following circumstances. 1. Its intensity. 2. Its duration. 3. Its certainty or uncertainty. 4. Its propinquity or remoteness. Chapter 4, Part 3. These are the circumstances which are to be considered in estimating a pleasure or a pain, considered each of them by itself. But when the value of any pleasure or pain is considered for the purpose of estimating the tendency of any act by which it is produced, there are two other circumstances to be taken into the account. These are: 5. Its fecundity, or the chance it has of being followed by sensations of the same kind, that is, pleasures, if it be a pleasure; pains, if it be a pain. 6. Its purity, or the chance it has of not being followed by sensations of the opposite kind, that is, pains, if it be a pleasure; pleasures, if it be a pain. These two last, however, are in strictness scarcely to be deemed properties of the pleasure or the pain itself. They are not, therefore, in strictness to be taken into the account of the value of that pleasure or that pain. They are in strictness to be deemed properties only of the act or other event by which such pleasure or pain has been produced, and accordingly are only to be taken into the account of the tendency of such act or such event. Chapter 4, Part 4. To a number of persons, with reference to each of whom, to the value of a pleasure or a pain is considered, it will be greater or less, according to seven circumstances. To wit, the six preceding ones, viz. 1. Its intensity. 2. Its duration. 3. Its certainty or uncertainty. 4. Its propinquity or remoteness. 5. Its fecundity. 6. Its purity. And one other, to wit, 7. Its extent, that is, the number of persons to whom it extends, or in other words, who are affected by it. Chapter 4, Part 5. To take an exact account, then, of the general tendency of any act by which the interests of a community are affected, proceed as follows. Begin with any one person of those whose interests seem most immediately to be affected by it, and take an account: 1. Of the value of each distinguishable pleasure which appears to be produced by it, in the first instance. 2. Of the value of each pain which appears to be produced by it, in the first instance. 3. Of the value of each pleasure which appears to be produced by it, after the first. This constitutes the fecundity of the first pleasure, and the impurity of the first pain. 4. Of the value of each pain which appears to be produced by it, after the first. This constitutes the fecundity of the first pain, and the impurity of the first pleasure. 5. Sum up all the values of all the pleasures, on the one side, and those of all the pains, on the other. The balance, if it be on the side of pleasure, will give the good tendency of the act, upon the whole, with respect to the interests of that individual person, if on the side of pain, the bad tendency of it upon the whole. 6. Take an account of the number of persons, whose interests appear to be concerned, and repeat the above process, with respect to each. Sum up the numbers expressive, of the degrees of good tendency, which the act has, with respect to each individual, in regard to whom the tendency of it, is good upon the whole. Do this again with respect, to each individual, in regard to whom the tendency of it, is good upon the whole. Do this again with respect, to each individual, in regard to whom the tendency of it, is bad upon the whole. Take the balance which, if, on the side of pleasure, will give the general good tendency of the act, with respect to the total number, or community of individuals concerned, if on the side of pain the general evil tendency, with respect to the same community. Chapter 4, Part 6. It is not to be expected that this process should be strictly pursued previously, to very moral judgment, or to very legislative or judicial operation. It may, however, be always kept in view, and as near as the process actually pursued on these occasions approaches to it, so near will such process approach to the character of an exact one. Chapter 4, Part 7. The same process is alike applicable to pleasure and pain, in whatever shape they appear, and by whatever denomination they are distinguished. To pleasure, whether it be called good which is properly the cause, or instrument of pleasure, or profit which is distant pleasure, or the cause or instrument of distant pleasure or convenience, or advantage, benefit, emolument, happiness, and so forth. To pain, whether it be called evil, which corresponds to good, or mischief, or inconvenience or disadvantage, or loss, or unhappiness, and so forth. Of motives. Chapter 10, Part 9. No motives either constantly good, or constantly bad. In all this chain of motives, the principal or original link seems to be the last internal motive, in prospect. It is to this that all the other motives, in prospect owe their materiality, and the immediately acting motive, its existence. This motive in prospect, we see, is always some pleasure, or some pain, some pleasure, which the act in question is expected to be a means of continuing or producing, some pain which it is expected to be a means of discontinuing or preventing. A motive is substantially nothing more than pleasure or pain, operating in a certain manner. Chapter 10, Part 10. Now pleasure is in itself a good, nay, even setting aside immunity from pain, the only good. Pain is in itself an evil, and indeed, without exception, the only evil, or else the words good and evil have no meaning. And this is alike true of a very sort of pain and of a very sort of pleasure. It follows, therefore, immediately and incontestably, that there is no such thing as any sort of motive that is in itself a bad one. Chapter 10, Part 11. It is common, however, to speak of actions as proceeding from good or bad motives, in which case the motives meant are such as are internal. The expression is far from being an accurate one, and as it is apt to occur in the consideration of most, a very kind of offense, it will be requisite to settle the precise meaning of it, and observe how far it quadrates with the truth of things. Chapter 10, Part 12. With respect to goodness and badness, as it is with everything else that is not itself either pain or pleasure, so is it with motives. If they are good or bad, it is only on account of their effects. Good, on account of their tendency to produce pleasure or avert pain. Bad, on account of their tendency to produce pain or avert pleasure. Now the case is that from one and the same motive, and from a very kind of motive, may proceed actions that are good, others that are bad, and others that are indifferent. Chapter 10, Part 14. It appears then that there is no such thing as any sort of motive which is a bad one in itself, nor consequently any such thing as a sort of motive which in itself is exclusively a good one. And as to their effects, it appears too that these are sometimes bad, at other times either indifferent or good. And this appears to be the case with a very sort of motive. If any sort of motive, then, is either good or bad, on the score of its effects, This is the case only in individual occasions, and with individual motives, and this is the case with one sort of motive, as well as with another. If any sort of motive then can, in consideration of its effects, be termed with any propriety a bad one, it can only be with reference to the balance of all effects it may have had of both kinds, within a given period, that is of its most usual tendency. Chapter 10, Part 30. What then? It will be said, are not lust, cruelty, avarice bad motives? Is there so much as any one individual occasion in which motives like these can be otherwise than bad? No, certainly. And yet the proposition that there is no one sort of motive but what will on many occasions be a good one is nevertheless true. The fact is that these are names which, if properly applied, are never applied but in the cases where the motives they signify happen to be bad. The names of those motives, considered apart from their effects, are sexual desire, displeasure, and pecuniary interest. To sexual desire, when the effects of it are looked upon as bad, is given the name of lust. Now lust is always a bad motive. Why? Because if the case be such that the effects of the motive are not bad, it does not go, or at least ought not to go, by the name of lust. The case is then that when I say lust is a bad motive, it is a proposition that merely concerns the import of the word lust, and which would be false if transferred to the other word used for the same motive, sexual desire. Hence we see the emptiness of all those rhapsodies of commonplace morality which consist in the taking of such names as lust, cruelty, and avarice, and branding them with marks of reprobation. Applied to the thing, they are false. Applied to the name, they are true indeed, but negatory. Would you do real service to mankind, show them the cases in which sexual desire merits the name of lust, displeasure, that of cruelty, and pecuniary interest, that of avarice? This completes The Reading of Happiness is the Greatest Good, by Jeremy Bentham, under the new free documentation license. This file in this and other formats is available on the internet at philosophy.lander.edu.